on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, a screaming eagle from the 101st Airborne, 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California. A longtime high school track coach and U.S. history and government teacher, he lived through some pretty significant history, like parachuting behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. He's been giving us a real detailed look into the pioneering training of paratroopers during World War II. This was a new idea, a new approach, and so we can understand the historic context of it all. In preparation for all those intense moments overseas, there's a whole lot of crucial experience the Army tried to build into you here in the States before you left.
We had to go through a lot of practice maneuvers to build the coordination squad to squad, platoon to platoon, company to company, battalion, and then build it up to regiment and division. And all of that was done at the Tennessee maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were the Blue Army at one time and a Red Army at another time. There's a motion picture about that where some of the airborne guys were going to capture the commanding general of the Red Army. They did.
And that was important because, as you would find out the hard way later, it can get pretty chaotic when you're jumping behind enemy lines, especially in the darkness and especially when you don't get let go or dropped off where you're supposed to be.
I was selected for some Pathfinder experiments, so there's another challenge.
And explain to everyone, I've had some Pathfinders on the show, but explain to folks who don't know what you're talking about what a Pathfinder would be and the significance.
Pathfinders would be dropped on the drop zone, and they would set up a signal. They would use an instrument called Rebecca, and it set up a signal that was picked up by the lead plane of a group of 45 that had an instrument called Eureka. That group of 45 aircraft would pick that signal up at about the distance of 20 miles, fly that signal, and on the ground where the Rebecca was being emitted. And that would be, according to in our division, it would be one of the letters of the Morse code. Our drop zones were A, B, C, D, almost in vertical alignment, except B was off the vertical alignment just a little bit. And it was underwater, and I can tell you a tough story about that one. I was picked to do some experimenting and to be dropped on the drop zone during the maneuvers. Mm-hmm. There were three of us. We dropped the night before on a Tennessee pine-covered area. Next to it was a watermelon patch. So I landed in a pine tree and bowed down, touched the ground. Nice. The other two guys were 50 yards from me. We got together, covered our parachutes up with pine needles, etc., and to sleep there that night. And then the next morning at 8 o'clock, the entire group of jumpers were going to come in. We were to set off orange canister signals on the drop zone. Mm-hmm. So that the pilot was sure he's coming in the right time in the right place at the right moment, following a signal given by the Pathfinders, who were maybe 8 or 9 in number, operating the Rebecca process, and they laid a T, a luminous T, on the drop zone. Aircraft would fly up the long leg of the T, where the cross piece met the long leg. That is when the green light and the aircraft would go on.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody goes out from that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we three were there that evening, hidden as best we could, all of our clothes and whatnot. And we slept there, and I heard a patrol come through, a Red Army patrol come through. So I alerted the other guy, two guys, and we were in our underwear. So we took off like rabbits. We went around in a big circle, and we found the watermelon patch. We came back where we were, hoping that the Red Army patrol was gone. They were. But we went back and picked up some watermelons from the and put them in the holes that we had dug, you know. And then the next morning when the guys came in, we distributed some watermelons to the guys in the squads.
You must have been popular.
Yeah. We got the orange signals off in time. I got those smoking the area. And a lieutenant colonel landed right next to me, and I didn't have my jacket on. He said, "Soldier, get that jacket on. The general will be here right now." So I did in a big hurry. That was my experience with the Pathfinders. It was never kept in the Pathfinders because I was a squad leader, and I had to go back to the squad for all the other activities.
But I imagine that experience, even though this was maneuvers and it's Americans against Americans, that experience of being a Pathfinder probably gave you an appreciation for what the Pathfinders in Europe went through and how dangerous that duty was.
Yeah, yeah. Because they are there by themselves with no support whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They had to set up quick and get those signals going because they're coming in by the thousands. Mm-hmm. There was 13,200 of us jumped in Normandy.
Right.
But anyway, we did with that experiment, and I didn't get in trouble with the watermelons, but I thought it was going to. And we maneuvered throughout the Tennessee area, mm-hmm. went back to Camp Mackle, and I did a 10-day activity and demolition training.
What did that consist of?
Making booby traps, working with dynamite, blasting caps, etc. We had to jump with 10 blasting caps, which is a pretty critical thing. They're fulminated things. You give them a real shock and, you know, they go. Mm-hmm. We padded those things up in our pockets and our legs. Make sure you make a proper landing and it'll go. You're done. If you're in the right pocket, you don't do your fall on the right side, for God's sakes. So,
otherwise, it's blasting Tom.
Yeah. So the sergeant instructor was showing us how a booby trap was made at a half-pound dynamite in the crotch of a tree with a tripwire, and he walked away from it, came back, and the half-pound dynamite began to slip. He reached up to grab it and cut the tripwire, and it exploded. It just tore up his right hand. So that was a bloody mess there. And said, oh, this is my first incident of real destruction. Mm. And it didn't stop from that point on.
I bet.
Well, we continued our training, and we went overseas to England. Then we trained and trained and trained, running through wheat fields, going over barbed wire fences, annoying the British, everything we possibly could. We were having a lot of fun because we knew how to have fun. We were risk takers, too. Mm-hmm. We're in a foreign country. We did things probably that were out of bounds, and we were 4,000 or more miles from home, and we knew nobody at home would ever hear about it.
Uh-huh.
You can fill that with all kinds of things that you want.
Well, you going to share any examples with us, or you going to leave it to our imagination?
Yeah, for instance, some of the guys would get in the tree on Lady Craven's estate, and she had a herd of deer. So the deer would mosey around, they would graze, they would do not. If they ever stood under a tree, one of the guys would jump out of the tree with a knife and kill a deer. That was not good diplomacy there.
No, not
those
at all.
Kinds of things, yeah.
But good venison, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And then we found catacombs. And we maneuvered in and around and dug into the catacombs, which was dangerous. And clergymen didn't like that.
Sure.
So we were required to cover those up. I was sent to the British 6th Parachute Infantry Regiment while we're in England to make contact with them, because the keynote was the colonel spoke of, you're going to have some relationships and the British 6th is going to be probably your friends. So get to know them. So two of us, we were both squad leaders, went to the British 6th, and we were oriented to their weapons. They were oriented to our activities, such as the rifle and the compass and all of that, all of those things, and what we looked like. We learned some demolition things there and how they were jumping. They were not jumping from aircraft. They were jumping from balloons. They couldn't afford to put mm-hmm. aircraft in the air.
Well, how about the buildup to Normandy? Were you starting to hear some rumblings that you guys were going to be sent across the channel?
No.
Nothing?
No.
It came out of the blue.
That was secret. We knew we're going to go to Europe, but mm-hmm. that's all. We don't know where we're going to land. We know how we're going to get there, but where we're going to land, who's going to be with us, whether it's going to be British or going to be a Polish group or French or whatever it may be. We got radio communication from Axis Sally quite a few times, and she said, we know you, the 501st Parachute Infantry, has just landed in England. We have 2,000 white crosses, not with your names on them, and you could use those crosses as stepping stones to get to the ground, and you won't need your parachutes because we're waiting for you.
Wow, that's encouraging.
Yeah, it was. So we gave her the raspberry, and she played good music after that, you know, all the Glenn Miller stuff.
Uh-huh.
A few things happened like that. So.
So I know that June 6th is a very special day in your life, one of, I'm sure, a lot of mixed emotions, and we're going to talk later about what you do every year on that date, but probably the most accurate label attached to that day in 1944 is the longest day. And I imagine it started earlier for you than most.
Oh, yeah, about 4 to 5 hours earlier. I believe our takeoff time was 10:21 English double summertime.
On June 5th?
Yeah.
So late at night on June 5th. And where were you guys in England?
We were in an assembly area. The exact spot, I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. It was very close to Merrifield Airport. There were 11 aerodromes in and about England where the paratroopers were gathering. Mm-hmm. And they would be taking off at different times, forming a wedge of 45 aircraft. Now, this mass armada is going to be 10 miles long. It's going to be at least 2 miles wide. The pathfinders are going to take, I believe, 57 minutes to get to their drop zones. The paratroopers are coming in at 60-some minutes. And then the next morning, gliders in 76 minutes. I think it's just about a kind of a guesswork on that schedule. So we had trained hard. We were isolated. No contact with anybody on the outside. Some of the guys had English girlfriends. Could not make contact with them. No connection with the civilian population whatsoever. There was guards all around this assembly area. On the evening of June 5, we met early evening, and we went to our aircraft. We had 6 parapacks underneath the slung underneath the aircraft. Each one weighed 300 pounds and had all of our equipment, probably machine gun, tripod, and ammunition, and maybe a bundle full of K-rations or TNT or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. 6 parapacks underneath. Each one weighed 300 pounds. We rolled those, packed them, and rolled them, and attached them to the aircraft, and then practiced a drop so that things going to work.
Mm-hmm. Is that just a lever that releases them or something?
Yeah, number two man behind, I jumped number one. Mm-hmm. Number two man had a switch. That would drop the 6 parapacks simultaneously. If that failed, number three man had a lever, and he would pull that lever, mechanical operation there. That would drop the 6 parapacks. So we had double check on that.
Mm-hmm. So you load onto this C-47?
The C-47 DC-3.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped number one, last one to get in the plane, so I was number one seat there. It's the shape of an arrow, and we were parked on the side, what do we call part of that arrow. Each plane would swing down and then take off. If any plane had a problem, there would be a mess.
Yeah.
On one of the planes taking off, there was a fella in the plane who fired his rifle into his foot. Evidently, he freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
The officer went over and grabbed him, lifted him up, banged him up against the bulkhead of the aircraft. Just as it was moving down the runway, not going very fast, took him to the door and threw him out.
Wow.
This guy bounced a little bit, and then the medis picked him up. And then an inquiry occurred later, after we came back from Normandy, and completely exonerated the officer. That's what he should have done. We never knew who this fellow was. That was kept quiet.
Wow.
We know who the officer was.
Right.
That was
right.
Good. But anyway, here we are on the takeoff field. Planes were taking off, one right after another, one every 10 seconds. I mean, when that plane revved up, it sounded like every rivet was going to come apart. You know, I mean, there was noise. I went forward, sat down on the lower deck, and leaned against the cockpit door and told the pilot that if there's any problem that relates to us, let me know. I'll fall back and wake up. So I stayed in that position most of the time until the officer in charge, Lieutenant Jansen, told me to get up there to number one. You know, above the door, there's 3 lights.
Mm-hmm.
There's a red, a white, and a green one. The pathfinders are already in. Some of them missed the drop zone. Some of them didn't. Some of them were spread so far apart that it's unbelievable. We got the worst drop in the entire 13,200.
Well, of course, we need to find out why you say that, but it's time for another break. Tom Rice of Coronado, California, our guest today. When we come back, we'll follow him out of that C-47 in the dark skies over France. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.